Game on.
Game on.
2FM.
And you're very welcome to Game On here on 2FM. It's Hugh Cahill with you until 8 o'clock tonight. We're crossing over to Old Trafford in a few minutes' time to get the latest ahead of the Champions League. Big night for United, as it was for Arsenal last night. And really, you're thinking, if they don't win their home games, they can kiss the Champions League quarterfinals goodbye. Conor O'Shea on rugby, always interesting. Shane Keegan on Wexford Youth's promotion to the Premier Division secured last Friday night. And Alan Colley and David Gillick are with me in studio tonight. You're both very welcome, lads.
Evening, Hugh.
Yeah, listen, it's good to have you in, David. Obviously, we're going to talk about the book a little bit later on, but were you playing much football this season with Ballantyre? How'd you go?
I was until Dublin decided to do well, and we haven't had a competitive game, I'd say, in about 2 months, because when
it's
the Dubs go,
shocker.
It is. It's frustrating now, to be brutally honest. We've had challenge games and things like that. We had one there last night, but you know, once the All Ireland is over, we're straight back into. So we've got a league game against Skerries now on Saturday. And
my cousin plays for Skerries. Watch out for Harry Dawson.
Oh, I know.
Big elbows. Yeah, elbows and boots. I taught him the elbows, not the boot part.
But it's just a little bit frustrating, because you've been waiting around all summer, and now the weather's closing in and things like that. And before you know it, we could be playing a playoff final in the first week of December. So it's a little bit disappointing, you know, when you stretch the whole year, and you know, you're trying to keep momentum going and keep.
How do you do that, David? I mean, we've talked about this so many times. It's so frustrating for the club player, and they're just treated like fourth class citizens in this whole thing.
You're just waiting around, you know. It's even with the championship side of it, at club level, you don't know any fixtures.
Yeah.
So you're trying to look at the fixture list at the start of the year and plan your year. And a lot of the lads, you know, there's a couple of things going on. Lads are getting married, people are going away on holidays, and they've deliberately put it off to October time so the season will be out. But it's not the case. We've three games left. So it's the clubs that suffer.
It's awful.
Without the club players, you'd have nothing, Hugh. So, and these are the everybody's complaining about the structures for so long now. So it's about time they've done something about it, because, as David said, they're the ones who suffer. They're the ones who are getting frustrated. You're not playing week in, week out like you're supposed to be. And to think the season's going to run into October, November, December, the weather that we're going to get in them months, it's just ridiculous.
I mean, if you play any sport, it doesn't matter what team event it is. If you're going along and you're training, you're trying to, for coaches as well, trying to keep the players, the intensity levels up, they need to be training towards something. And if they don't know when that something is, just forget about it.
It is. It's very difficult. And, you know, I look at kind of what they do in, let's say, rugby in the AIL. Like, they literally have their if you take a club like Clontarf, they'll have their fixtures and they're set in stone, and that's the way it is. So you can plan, you can periodise your training, you know exactly when to like push the players to back off.
Yeah.
Whereas in GAA this summer, it's been really difficult.
And like someone explained to me, isn't the GAA all about the club? Isn't that what the community, the club, you know, that's where it all starts for all the players?
The amateur game and all this that
and
we keep hearing about.
Like
so
dirt.
Well, there you go. And especially, I suppose, Hugh, as well, because Dublin, it's not like they're going to go away anytime soon. So they need to sort out their county structures in terms of how good their senior team is, because they're going to go into the latter stages for the next 10, 15 years with the team that they have, as we all know. So they need to get their house in order, certainly in terms of the club.
We have to get to a stage where, you know, if you're playing for your county, you sacrifice your club season, and that's just the be all and end all. And maybe the coaches might let, say, the fringe players outside the 23 that they would have in their first thing to go and play and rejoin the panel then for Dublin training. And maybe that's just the way it is. That's the price you have to pay as being an elite player.
Isn't it one thing we see as well, Hugh? Kilkenny do it a lot, don't they? That they release the players back, like Brian Cody in between semi-finals and finals, which, like, you often hear, you think they're wrapped up in cotton wool. Mm. But he says that, no, we'll be back with the club for 2 or 3 weeks and then we'll meet up again with the county team.
Yeah.
I think they do. So yeah, it's something like that's one thing that the rugby are very good at as well. When you obviously see the lads when they're not playing, Joe Schmidt might release them back to go play at Munster or Leinster or wherever it may be at the weekend and get a game under their belt, because as you know, everybody just wants to play. Nobody training,
you want to play matches.
Training,
you want to play competitive matches. Like challenges are all well and good, but you want to play the league games, the games that actually matter, the championship games. And like you said there, when you refer to rugby, the rugby still continues. So when the Six Nations is on, you know, the pro all the league games are still continuing. So the players who aren't, say, playing international, they're still playing games.
Yeah.
They still go and continue. And that's something that I think, particularly in Dublin, that I found, it's quite difficult during the summer. You're training away and you don't know what's happening. So we've got three fixtures left and only two we've actually got firm dates. There's one fixture we don't know when that's going to take place.
Yeah. And then for everybody else who's been out of the championship, my own County Wicklow, as I said before, you know, Pats and Rat New are playing the county final, I think, next weekend. That's all been done and dusted. They're all ready to go. You know, I mean, it's
all over the shop. Especially lads, as David referred to, their lads who have plans or go on holidays or get married or different things. Like, they're putting their life on hold because they haven't a clue when their fixtures are coming up. They can't plan anything. It's
very frustrating. Listen, I take it there was many an accumulator undone by Arsenal last night, losing at home 3-2. What was going on there?
Yeah, well, Arsenal was a surprise one, Hugh. But in some ways, I was thinking about it today. I'm not a whole lot surprised with the way the European results are going for the English teams, because we have this expectation, I suppose, us looking in from the outside and everybody kind of Sky and everybody hyping it up to the Premier League that we keep hearing is this great league. But when you look at the fixtures on a Saturday at the weekend with the teams who were struggling, Chelsea, I watched them against Newcastle, they were dreadful on Saturday. So it's not a great surprise for me to see them struggling in Europe.
Is it tactically? Is it the conditioning? Is it the style of football that's being played in Europe versus what they're used in the Premier League? What I read an interesting piece in the Telegraph today, and there was six reasons offered, and they went through each one from the perceived lack of physicality that exists in Europe versus the Premier League, the lack of tactical awareness of how to play a game, that in the Premier League they go gung-ho for everything from the very start, that it's bang, 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 attack, 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 and that's actually a naive way to approach it. Loads of different reasons why they're not competing, but you know, you put them all together and you say fine, but
I think it is an accumulation of a few reasons, Hugh, but I suppose one thing that the English clubs used to be good at when United had their good team under Ferguson and different things when they were competing and doing well, even Chelsea, they used the Premier League and the English style as an advantage to them, because the intensity that they played at, that when they went into Europe, the European teams were like, whoa, because they didn't see
they couldn't
that.
Handle them.
Yeah, they couldn't handle the intensity that they were playing at, because obviously on the continent it's slightly different in terms of it's more possession based and tactical. But I think as it's kind of gone on and progressed over the years, when you get to that stage now, it's so much based, all football is based now around kind of the possession game and keeping the ball. And I just think when they get into Europe, the English teams struggle to keep the ball. And as you said, it's about game management then in terms of...
And all the best players are going to Spain and France and Italy.
Yeah, well, the best players here are just costing too much money. It's ridiculous. Like, that's why I think as well it's hyped up so much, that you can get lads who are playing in Spain and all over the place on far less money and less wages. And like, look at the money that's involved now at Man City and the players. Now look at the team. It certainly looks exciting tonight on paper with the team they've lined up. But I think looking at it tonight, I'd fancy the two Manchester teams to get a win.
Okay, well, let's cross over to Old Trafford. As I say, the Champions League back tonight. City and Manchester United in action. Jim Beglin is part of RT's match commentary team at Old Trafford. They're playing Wolfsburg from the Bundesliga. Hiya, Jim. How are you?
Hi, Hugh.
Listen, United are in a similar position to Arsenal were last night. I mean, they have to win this one, really.
Well, they do. And they've got tough opponents tonight. I mean, I thought they did reasonably well in Eindhoven. I thought they were a little unfortunate to lose out, but and of course sickening night as well for Luke Shaw. But as to kind of all the English sides in Europe so far, or seen even the Premier League start, Manchester United have probably been the most consistent, and now they're beginning to convince a little bit. I agree with Van Gaal and what he said about the fact that they've come on in really well since this time last season. I've seen a lot of United in the Premier League over the last couple of seasons, and I think they really have, and they're developing into something stronger now and more consistent. But this is a big one tonight, and we'll see how they deal with the pressure. It's another step for them.
Do you think that people, Manchester United fans specifically, have been a bit too hasty in their judgment of Van Gaal? He has got a lot of criticism for things that he's done. But would you be prepared to give him more time? And do you think that is a bit of a plan coming together now?
Well, I thought he created kind of problems for himself last season by just being a little confused as to what his lineup was going to be, because he was certainly earlier in the season he was going between a back three and a back four, and I thought the side looked a bit confused. He also played a lot of players out of position, and I think you can get away with that to an extent, but ultimately it will catch up on you, and I think it did. I think now he's bought, I think, cleverly again in the summer, and I'm not talking about Tom Cleverley there, but I think he's bought intelligently, I should say, in the summer.
Yeah.
And I think they have the makings now of a very good side. I mean, when I was tipping at the start of the season, I thought maybe fourth. Now they find themselves top of the Premier League. As to whether they can sustain that, I'm not so sure. But I do think he probably has been over-criticised. But then again, isn't everybody these days? I mean, we have instant judgment. After one match, you're a world beater, and after another, you're hopeless.
Yeah.
So I think he has been probably dealt with a little harshly. Although, as I say, he did make mistakes which contributed towards that.
I remember when Martial, when the deal was kind of being concluded and the price tag was thrown around, and people went looking at his form and his reputation, and 19 years of age, you're kind of going, are we spending too much money here for a guy who hasn't really proved it? He seems to have given the club a massive lift, Jim, or maybe I'm reading too much into just him, but it just seems like that from a distance.
No, I think he has. I was here when he scored his first goal for Manchester United against Liverpool, and a lot of comparisons at the time were being made to Henry as to the potential he has, and you know, he could go on to be that good. That's why they paid the money. I was shocked at the money they paid. 36, which can rise into the 50s, 58, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I just thought that was just kind of off the scale, just madness. But looking at him now, he does look like the real deal. He seems to have it all. He's got the pace, and Van Gaal kept talking about that in pre-season, about he needs creativity and pace. And he's added that with Memphis and now, of course, with Martial. So not only does he have kind of great running power, great pace, wonderful control of the ball with it, but he looks as if he can actually play the number nine role. He looks as if he can kind of cope with the physicality of the Premier League. And he's young, he's full of energy. So, yeah, I think he has given the club a significant lift at the moment. As to whether he can sustain it, because he's still young, he's still learning, we'll have to wait and see. But he looks the part for me.
On a general point, Jim, I mean, do you think, I was reading a piece today in the Telegraph which outlined what they believe are the serious problems that Premier League teams have when they go into European competition. And we were talking about the Arsenal result last night, we're talking about Chelsea losing to Porto. You add those into the first round results as well, with City and United and indeed Arsenal. And you can make a case now that maybe English teams are struggling in Europe. Do you think that there is a lot of cause to be concerned?
Well, I think at the moment, yes, in the short term, but we shouldn't get too carried away with this either, because okay, I know Arsenal are in a difficult position because they've got two games against Bayern Munich coming up next. So they could be in real trouble. But as for the other three, I mean, I still think there's every possibility that they can emerge from the group stage. So, you know, the panic that we're seeing at the moment, you know, won't be as great then. I still think it's recoverable. But I just think if you want to kind of the short answer at the moment is, the Premier League sides are not playing well enough.
Yeah.
It is as simple as that. I mean, Arsenal have the same weaknesses. They're not working hard enough off the ball, and they're making defensive mistakes. Arsene Wenger's rotation has backfired a little bit too. Chelsea have gone from little horse to champion stallion to what seems like the knacker's yard.
Yeah.
And they're making terrible defensive errors at the moment. You know, five away games this season in the Premier League and the Champions League, and they've conceded 12 goals now. I mean, that's just unlike Chelsea. And I think Manchester City, we know, began in fearsome form. But I don't know, there's something inbuilt in Manchester City now. It's like as if they have an insecurity somehow. And the Champions League keeps haunting them, you know. And
yeah,
I think Pellegrini's commitment to attack, I think, makes them a little vulnerable at the back as well. And as I said about Manchester United earlier, a little unfortunate in Eindhoven. And I think there's a lot of pluses about them. And I think they have improved, and they are improving.
Do you think, just very briefly on Chelsea, do you think John Terry should come back in and start, Jim?
Yeah, I mean, I know people were saying that his kind of time is up, but I just think, I know, and again, I know he made some mistakes, but Ivanovic has been relatively hopeless. He's picked up slightly of late. Ivanovic has had a terrible time of it. I was at Newcastle on Saturday. What Zuma was doing for the first Newcastle goal when Perez stuck it in, I have no idea. That was madness. So it's not as if it's just John Terry making mistakes. It's them all. John Terry is, or certainly last season and throughout his Chelsea career, has been a huge part of that dressing room. He is their leader. And I think maybe Mourinho was a little hasty in dropping him. And I think he probably could go back to him at the moment just to try and settle everything down and steady things. Because like the other players, you know, Terry will come out of it. He'll snap out of it. I know people point to his age, but you know, with the likes of Zuma, who's got the legs beside him, or Cahill, and certainly in front of him with Matic, who's not been on great form, who was dropped last night, I suppose. You know, Terry can cope.
Okay. Run through the United team. De Gea in goals. Smalling, Darmian, Juan Mata, Blind, Valencia, Schneiderlin, Schweinsteiger, Depay, Martial and Rooney is captain up front. It's an attacking United team on the face of it. They're at home. You're expecting a win tonight?
Yeah, I am. I don't think it'll be easy because Wolfsburg have come on in leaps and bounds over the last couple of seasons. You know, they're German Cup holders. They beat Bayern in the Super Cup. Their kind of season came to a bit of an abrupt halt when Lewandowski did what he did last week to them. But I Manchester United, I think they've assembled certainly that attacking four that lines up tonight is very expensive, and I think they've got to deliver. Carrick, I think the stats tell you, Manchester United, do better with Carrick in the side, but I think he's been rotating between Carrick, Schneiderlin and Schweinsteiger. I think the fact that he's got Schneiderlin and Schweinsteiger, it shouldn't affect them too much. So yeah, I expect a lot of forward momentum from Manchester United tonight. And here's probably another prediction I'll get wrong. I usually do with you, but I will go for them to win. And because of Gladbach's start as well, to the Bundesliga season has been so poor, I fancy Manchester City to do the business in Germany.
5-2, the double, Jim. I'll go with you. I'm going to stick a few quid on. Listen, enjoy the match tonight. Thanks a million.
Cheers to you.
Game on.
Game on.
2FM.
And you're very welcome back. Okay, 51552 for your text. Anything you want to ask David or Alan over the course of the next while, please feel free. And I suppose, look, we want to talk a bit about nutrition because the book is out.
Yeah.
How's it going?
It's going really well. It's been out, a week and a half now.
Okay.
So I'm delighted to see it on the shelf because I didn't realise how tough putting a book together is. It's I probably started this whole process about a year ago.
Okay.
And it's something I've always wanted to do, mainly because I'm into food and I'm into the performance element of it. But when I retired, I got away from it. I didn't really look after myself, even from staying active, but also in the kitchen. I wasn't really eating properly.
That's to be expected, though, maybe.
Yeah, no, it is. Absolutely. Because I've been looking at it so intensely. Like, you know, I looked at that as a lifestyle. It wasn't a diet. It was my lifestyle. I looked at it 7 days a week, 11 months of the year. For that 1 month, I'd let my hair down.
Well, how I keep justifying it every now with the Hungry Dory.
45
I've done it for long enough.
Yeah.
Hey, the food police are in this evening. They put them away. but it was kind of, you know, after retiring, then I kind of really realised the benefit of actually having a healthy diet. And
did you notice your mood changed?
Oh, huge. Yeah, huge.
Really?
It was just more from an energy perspective.
Okay.
You know, I kind of felt when I was eating like poor quality food, say in the morning time, it wasn't setting the day up right. And if I had a poor lunch, then in the afternoons, I was always tired and then grumpy. And you know, my productivity levels were low. I just felt I wasn't performing, you know, and that was the big thing. And that's when I really realized, you know what, like, you know, I'm facing challenges now in that transitional phase, and I need to be performing. I need to be, you know, you're dealing with people, so you need to just be on your game a little bit. And I kind of felt I need to get back in, one, staying active again, and also just looking after what I'm eating.
Did anyone actually say that to you, that they noticed a difference, or was this something that you just felt yourself, look, I just don't have the energy levels?
It was a bit of both. I think the wife was looking at me, yeah, going, you are wrecking my head, will you start eating properly again? And then it was, I just noticed it myself, but it was also kind of my self-esteem, confidence, things like that, where, you know, okay, like aesthetics do come into it, you know, you feel as if you're putting on a bit of weight, you're feeling heavy, lethargic, and just I just felt I was getting like miles away from what I was doing over the last couple of years, and that was training and you know, looking after myself and having more energy throughout the whole day.
Okay, now, so because obviously, look, I mean, athletics and competing at an international level has been part of your life for so long, maybe it's a little bit easier for you just in terms of, because you're used to it and you know exactly what it takes. But maybe for someone who's listening here saying, look, I need to actually get more energy, I need to eat better, I need to actually start preparing the foods properly. How difficult is it to make that big change, do you think, in lifestyle?
To be brutally honest, I don't think it's that difficult.
It's
a mind shift. You've got to want to do it, and you've got to kind of start just building that into a daily routine, a weekly routine. So it starts by when you shop. What you put into the basket or the trolley is what you're going to take home with you. And that's where I learned the most, was literally walking around a supermarket and actually looking at the products that I was putting in the trolley. And as basic as it sounds, you won't see a massive list of ingredients on the back of an apple. And it comes back to literally how simple it is. Real food. Eat real food. And the problem is that nowadays we're very busy, we're very rushed, and we'll tend to just go to the easiest thing, the ready-made meal or whatever that is, and just grab it because we've got to get that done. But if we can just take a little bit of time and focus on and eating real food, we're on the right track.
So, and, yeah, so the book then basically allows people to cook real food, as you say, and yeah. stuff that actually is manageable and doable. And if you just a little bit of planning, that's all.
Yeah, not even like kind of like planning, because people be like, oh, you know, I'm in work, I'm busy and stuff like that. But it goes back to, like, you know, in the book, my philosophy is it has to be simple. It has to be something that's practical. I'm not going to give massive ingredients lists or huge methods that are going to take time. We don't have time for that. People don't have time. If you're working 8-9 hours a day, you've got kids, you're coming in the evening, you want something that's quick and easy, but it's healthy and it's tasty.
Okay.
So, like, all the ingredients are readily available, you know, in your local shops. It's not like here's one ingredient that you have to go an hour away to get. You know, it's not like that whatsoever. You literally, local shops, bringing it home, something that's practical and easy to implement.
Because that would put a lot of people off. I mean, it's the, you know, you watch a cookery show on TV, or you get a recipe handed, you think, oh, that looks fantastic, and then you go through what you actually need to go and make it, and you're thinking, what in the name of, where am I getting this stuff from? And yeah. actually, you know, I wouldn't even know where to start.
No, and that's it. And it has to be something that's sustainable. This can't be something that, you know, okay, you cook a meal here, you cook a meal there. It's something that has to be sustainable. And that's why the practical element is key to all of this. And that's what I wanted to really get across. I wanted to showcase, you know, that healthy food doesn't have to be one boring. You can make it taste good, but it doesn't have to be this big, massive chore and something that's going to require a lot of your time. You can simply do little things that are going to improve your own energy levels, but also just your quality of life. You have more energy, you feel better about yourself, you're spending more time with your family in the evenings where you have that energy and you're enjoying it, you're recovering, and then get on the next day.
We've spoken to Graham Byrne about this, who's the strength and conditioning coach at Dundalk, and he went through some stuff. Can I just ask you, just on a basic level then, so what would be a typical breakfast then for you?
Typical breakfast would be I'd start off with oats.
Okay.
I'd add in a bit of Greek yogurt.
Yeah.
And I'd put in some nuts, seeds, and a few berries.
Okay.
That's my
I
breakfast.
Thought only horses eat oats.
Porridge oats.
I'm out already.
And what? Okay, so then that keeps you going until when?
That will keep me going for probably about 2 hours. We should be aiming to eat every 2 to 3 hours.
Okay.
So a snack then, I'd have a good snack in and around, let's say around 11, half 10, 11 o'clock. And that could be anywhere from like Greek yogurt and berries again, or say something along the lines of peanut butter, some nuts, some seeds, things like that. So good protein source, low on kind of like your sugary carbohydrates. So try and steer clear of that. So that would be around about a snack. And then into lunchtime, again, protein on the plate. So whatever, if you're, you know, for me, chicken, turkey, whatever it is. And then load of salad. Salad, some vegetables, the more colour, the better. And then some kind of good fast avocados, feta cheeses. And if I am going to be active, if I'm training in the afternoon or in the evening, I'd put on a slow release carbohydrate. So things like this, like quinoa or quinoa.
Quinoa, yeah, yeah.
Or sweet potato, things like that is what I would try and have.
Okay, all right. And look, in terms of the book then, you go through how the stuff is all done, you know, different recipes, basic food ingredients.
Yeah, it's all broken into, like, you know, breakfast, lunch, dinner, and snacks as well. And then, look, there is desserts as well, because I'm human. I do like a treat now and again. And it has to be, like I said, something that's sustainable. So there is desserts in there as well. But I kind of give a bit of philosophy about why food is, like, I'm interested in food and what I believe it can do to you as an individual. But just, like, it's all simple, like, fairly simple steps. And that's what I wanted. I didn't want to kind of come across with these highfalutin recipes that are just impossible to implement. It's just not going to happen.
And look, I suppose we've spoken about again this before, people will train and train and train and they won't notice a huge amount of difference, or they're getting frustrated because they're not making the gains that they want, but they don't realise that diet is such a huge part of everything.
Absolutely. I think what's the phrase, abs are made in the kitchen. And I truly believe, you know, from if you're someone who wants to, say, lose a bit of weight or tone up, it all comes down to your diet. You know, it's there's no point going out and putting in the hard graft in the gym or out running or whatever your activity is and then coming home and just eating poor quality food. It's, you reap what you sow, and it has to go in parallel. Be active, but also back that up by having a good nutritious diet.
Okay, can I ask you your thoughts on what's been going on with athletics over the last while?
We
only have
this is all about me here.
I tell you, like, it's depressing if you're a sports fan. I imagine it's depressing even more if you're an athletics fan. And then to be somebody who has competed at the very top level, to see what has come out in the last while, how do you feel about it?
Yeah, you know, I do. I feel really, really disappointed and sick. And if I'm truly honest, it's getting harder and harder to defend my sport. With everything that comes out, like everything from the documentaries, what was going on in Russia, all the blood profile and all this sort of stuff, it's, you know, sometimes I kind of question, God, was I that naive, you know? Did I actually believe that there was clean athletes. And there is clean athletes. And I don't want to paint it all very negative and say that everyone's on drugs, because they're not. Mm. But unfortunately, there is a few out there. And, you know, what really got me was what was going on in Russia. That systematic approach where they were all kind of been tested before they were going to the championships. And if they failed a test, well, then they wouldn't send that athlete, they send another athlete. And that makes so much sense when I look back over my career, because the Russians were always coming out with these fast times that were ran in Russia, but okay, they'd never materialized at a championship. And that was quite remarkable. But then also what's been going on about kind of these tests been brushed under the carpet, and I think the IAAF and all the people that sit up in the comfy seats have an awful lot to answer for. And, you know, Seb Coe coming in now, has,
is he going to make a difference?
He has got a massive job in his hands. He has to do something, because that's the eyes of the world are now on the sport. And if he's not seen to implicate anything or change anything or make things a little bit tougher, well, then he has failed.
Because it just seems that if you want to cheat, there's always a way to do it. And no matter how good the testing is or how good the science behind the testing is, that the cheaters, if they want to make it happen, they will make it happen.
And I think, you know, we have to say, like, what is doping? Mm. The actual, you know, that grey area around what is doping is constantly changing. So, you know, you've got this TUE form. So a TUE form is for anyone that's, say, an asthmatic, has to take an inhaler. So you get a TUE, a therapeutic use exemption form. And there's athletes out there that are manipulating that system. They're saying that they have these certain conditions, and because they have maybe money behind them, they can get a doctor to rubber stamp it, and lo and behold, they're taking all sorts of stuff for a performance enhancing benefit. But then also you've got like what's called microdoping. So there's certain levels in your body that you're able to have your body natural produce testosterone and things like that. But what's happening is some of these athletes are now going and getting tested to see where they are on that scale. And if they're very low, well, then they're topping up. So they're constantly kind of checking where they are and topping themselves up. In a way, that is micro-doping, you know, because some athletes don't have the access to those resources, whereas other people do, and other people have the backing. And I think it comes down to, you know, fame and fortune. Whatever is fame and fortune, you will get cheats. Now, I kind of believe as well that the IAAF do have to get a lot stronger on like banning athletes as well. We're too lax for years. Like 2 years is nothing.
But there's no deterrent really.
There's no real deterrent. 2 years is absolutely nothing. Now they have improved it to 4, and now there's the life bans and things like that. But it's, you know, you look at Tyson Gay and kind of, yes, he gave information, and next minute he's allowed back to compete. And the 100 metres is, there's a lot of past drug cheats in there. And it is disappointing from that.
You see, just on that then, right? While you brought, I mean, because I found this fascinating, you know, all the, you know, the social media around the race between the World Championships between Justin Gatlin and Usain Bolt. Yeah. And it was billed against, you know, good against evil, you know, the saviour of athletics versus the doper who's, you know, shouldn't be even racing anymore. And I'm kind of scratching my head saying, this doesn't sit right with me. It just doesn't sit right with me. And Usain Bolt has never failed a drugs test that we know of. And, you know, Justin Gatlin's record is quite obvious. But I just don't think that we can be as black and white as this guy is bad, this guy is good, therefore good wins and athletics is saved.
No.
But the fact that it was even billed like that, Hugh, tells you how wrong it was. Because it shouldn't have been the case at all. It should have been all working off an even keel, a good race, made a best man win the way it should be, without any kind of sideshow or whatever was going on with that. And even going back to David's point there, that's the problem, is the punishments are not severe enough, because fellas are feeling, well, look, I can take a chance here, I may get away with it, what's the worst that'll happen to me, 18 months, 2 years, I'll be back again. Whereas, do you honestly think there should be life bans?
Oh yeah, I do. Yeah, that's that question. Absolutely. It's the only way that we can really try and eradicate this and put a deterrent in. But, you know, it's very difficult as well, because sometimes, and what we've seen in the past with the whole Victor Conte and Balco and things like that, the people who are manufacturing these drugs are actually ahead of the game. Mm. They're making things that haven't been or can't be tested for.
Yeah.
And
something like the cycling situation.
Absolutely. And like that's, you know, that comes down to science. And if we're, it's, you know, it's like crime and punishment, you know. If there's crime out there, it's very hard to catch it before it happens.
Sure.
You know, and that's the same with the drugs, yeah, unfortunately.
Where you stand on the Gatlin Bolt thing? I mean, what was your own thoughts on it?
Oh, I don't want to see Gatlin run, you know. Yeah. And I know people say, oh, he's doing his time, but what about the clean athlete? What about that athlete that finished fourth, fifth, or sixth? You know, they don't get a second chance.
You were in that position.
Yeah, that's a great point, Hugh. Exactly. What about the lads who finished? There's never a mention of them.
David, was it? You were in that position.
Yeah, like in 2009, I finished sixth in the world champs. And people will always say, oh, did you ever get done out of medals? I finished sixth in the world. To me, finishing fifth meant everything. To me, finishing fourth meant anything. It wasn't just about the medals. But the guy who won that race, LeSean Merritt, he got done for drugs 2 months after that race. And he only served a, half ban because he went along with the investigation, etc. But I kind of felt, God, you know, who else in that race was on drugs? Where did I really finish? You know, and I don't get a second chance. Like Sean Merritt did. He took drugs and then he got back and won a medal recently.
That has to be the point. It's the good fellas who are suffering.
And it's not only just that individual. If you take, for example, like Olive Loughnane could be in line to get a gold medal from Berlin as well. She finished second. She could get upgraded to gold, right? That athlete has trained. They've trained so much for that experience, right? And if they get a medal, they do a lap of honour, they get on the podium, the national anthem.
Memories, photos, everything.
But it can bring something to the sport at home. It can get kids into it. It can get media attention, etc., etc. That's not there. If you're out of that, you won't get that. And that's what's happened. So that person, you know, regardless of the person that took the drugs, that clean athlete won't get that experience ever again.
Question. Can you please answer this, David? Greek yogurt, full fat or zero fat?
Full fat.
Full fat, really? Why?
Yeah, full fat.
Does it better for you?
You got to eat fat to burn fat.
Okay. That's one of those good fats like avocados and blah, blah, blah. Okay. Just tuned in. What's the name of the book for healthy eating? Give it one more plug there.
It's David Gillick's Kitchen from the track. Good food from the track to the table.
Mercer Press. Okay, good stuff. Dave's going to stay with us and Alan as well, but we're going to move on to rugby because Connor O'Shea is on the line. Hi, Connor.
How are you?
Not too bad, thanks. Yeah, listen, first of all, I just need to ask you, what's the mood like in England at the moment, Connor, after what happened last weekend? I mean, obviously you're coaching over there, you're in the thick of things. How are the English rugby public taking that result against Wales?
Oh, I mean, it's just unbelievable, the reaction and the pressure. Not unbelievable, the reaction. The expectation has been huge, but the reaction in some sections has just been incredible. I mean, did England lose a game they should have won? Yes. You only get one chance, but like the other way of looking at it, still, if you're the host nation, you're the home nation, you'd expect there's still a five games to win a World Cup. And I know, you know, people say that's delusional, but that's what it is for a lot of teams now. And they have a knockout game. They have a last 32, so to speak, against Australia this weekend. They have an easy game against Uruguay. They win this weekend, it's back in their control. And they have to look at what they did well last week and move on. But the reaction and the former players and coaches and the way they're getting stuck in is incredible. And I've bumped into a few of the Irish guys who are training in Guildford's, where we train as well at Harlequins, and they're slightly taken aback by the level of ferocity being aimed at the England team.
Yeah, but and I can understand, you know, why that's the case, but equally you think some of it is way over the top. And as you said, some former internationals as well have really been getting stuck in. I suppose because England are hosting this tournament, Connor, because it's been a brilliant 2 weeks and because, you know, they expected a lot of England in this tournament, that maybe that's why it's manifesting himself in this kind of, it's kind of nearly vitriol at this stage.
Yeah, but they're not out. That's the amazing thing. So, I mean, if you look at the way, you know, teams, you'd expect to support each other. Oh, listen, it was you can reflect and as well and look at Ireland's point of view, because I don't think we haven't been involved in the game of that ilk. We haven't been involved in New Zealand, Argentina, and that's the nagging worry I have, is that we're suddenly going to be confronted with a game of, I mean, fair play to Wales for hanging in. They should have lost by 15 points. You know, when you look at the game back, you go, how the hell were they in it? Well, England were ill-disciplined, gave them penalty. Dan Biggar was incredible. But the sheer intensity of the occasion is something we're almost under the radar. I know that sounds almost weird, doesn't it, Hugh, to say, because you've got 90,000 people packed in Wembley. It's not really under the radar, but yeah. It's a game that there was no doubt of the result at any stage. Were Romania physical? Were they brave? Yes, they were. But were Canada physical and brave? Yes, they were. But there was never any doubt where it was going. And there's been some games that are at a different level. And the trouble is, the further you go into the tournament, you don't get a second chance. South Africa have a second chance. England have a second chance. They mightn't take it, but by the time Ireland get into these big games, there will be no second chance. And we have to make sure we're right on it when we play those games. And I'm actually hoping that we're really tested by Italy.
Yeah.
I want to see us tested, because only then will we be really battle-hardened for what will be France and New Zealand or Argentina and beyond, because you need that sort of level of intensity. You just suddenly don't arrive to it. So I'm really hoping this Sunday we see a big uplift. We see the Italians perform the way we know we can. They can when Sergio Parisa is, you know, back in harness, and if he is back in harness. But you want to see that step up, and that Ireland are really tested this weekend by Italy.
And we'll talk about the Italians in just one second, but I know you know Chris Robshaw so well, Conor. I just wonder how he's feeling this week and how you think he will respond, knowing him as you do.
He'll be fine. Will he hurt from losing? Yes, who doesn't? That man has faced adversity so many times in his life, let alone his rugby career, and he's always come out the other side fighting. That's what makes him a very special individual. So I've no doubt. I had a good chat with them on Sunday. I leave the view well enough alone when they're in England camp, but I thought I'd give them a ring to offer a bit of support on Sunday and have a good chat with them. And he was fine. And actually, in a strange way as well, Nick Easter being called up for Chris is a really good person for Chris to have, because they're very close. And Nick's experience, whether he's in the match day 23 or whether he's just in the 31, just to have him around for Chris will be a really good person. So I think in some ways that, by luck rather than design, the right sort of person for Chris has come into camp. And I'm sure Nick, in his own inimitable way, will put his arm around him, crack a few jokes about what's going on, and Chris will be right back where he wants to be. But I've no doubt that Chris will... We're not allowed to bet in rugby, but if I had to put money on a man who might get man of the match this weekend, I'd put it on Chris.
Yeah, that was... I mean, we've spoken about Chris before, you and I, just after a few different occasions, and without putting words in your mouth, you have absolutely no qualms about him continuing as England captain?
No. He's the second most captain of all time now. He's done something right.
Yeah.
He's won plenty of both the club and international level, and he is an outstanding leader. Leaders have to make big decisions, and those big decisions are dissected. And I always say, the decision and the execution have to be two completely separate issues. And there's a third area that no one controls, and that's actually the officiating. So the decision, everyone can debate, and hindsight will always give people the right answer. The execution, you look at, did the execution actually go right in what they were trying to do when they bowled it? And the third thing, which nobody actually bothered picking up on, was that, and listen, you do what you need to do, but Wales were unbelievably illegal defending them all. They sacked both lifters without getting technical. They came in from the side. They should have been penalised three times. They weren't. That's life. And when you're in a rugby game, there are things you don't control, and that's what you don't control. If I were Wales, I'd have done exactly what they did. They were fighting for their lives, but they got away with it. The rest is history. So they're all the things you look at. And I always say to Chris, as long as his decision-making process was right, then don't hindsight coach. Don't just look at the results and say, every Tom, Dick and Harry is looking at the results and telling me I should have done something differently. What was I thinking, and why did I do that? And if that decision-making process is right, yes, you reflect and learn, but don't look back at a decision that you know the outcome of and make it right or wrong because of that outcome. You know, that's all I'd say to anyone.
Absolutely. Okay, brilliant. We spoke to Paul Griffin on the show last night, former Italy scrum half, about where Italian rugby is going, Conor, and I suppose the worries that Italy fans might have looking at the ageing squad they have, the lack of new faces over the last few years, and I suppose what happens when Parise goes and Castro Giovanni goes and those leaders that, you know, we've, I suppose, come to know and love over the last few years. You wouldn't have a huge amount of optimism for Italy going into the next couple of games.
I think out of all that, you actually get an opportunity then maybe to look at other people stepping up and leading in its own way, because I think you can't but be impressed with it, and he'll be a threat. If Parise is back with Eduardo Gori at nine, then he's been a real, really good performer for them, and he'll threaten the Irish around the fringes. You wait for team selection. People like Sarto, Campagnaro, if he's in Bonditi, they can play a bit.
Mm.
They haven't performed. There's no doubt about that. Their scrum has been really weak in terms of what you expect traditionally from Italy. And they'll base a lot of what they do about that ability to be able to scrum, get penalties. We've known them historically through of being able to dominate stroke bully. Actually, if anything, the back five of their scrum is stronger. And their back line, they've got some young fellas who have actually got a bit about them. So they haven't performed. They haven't given a performance like you've seen from some of the other teams in the tour, like in Japan, who even in defeat to Scotland, I thought were outstanding. And what was unfair for Japan was they had to play 4 days after they had played against South Africa, and they fell apart. So that's what it, but the maiden mentally, when the pressure is off, when you've got someone like Parise walking back in, and big players make a difference. So, you know, their future is now. The Italian future is about Ireland, but it's about Romania and winning, making sure they're turned, making sure they're pre-qualified for the next World Cup, and making sure they have a lot of good young players there. So they have domestic issues, they've got international issues, they'll sort them out, and these things happen like that. But it'll be really interesting to see the performance they put in this weekend against Ireland. And I want Italy to play well and stretch Ireland, because I think we need it.
Okay, and then just finally, because this has been the biggest debating point all week for Irish rugby fans. If you were Joe Schmidt, Connor, which two wingers would you start this weekend? Come on.
Well, I better not say what I saw when we trained. We were watching them train a bit yesterday.
Go on.
What would I do? I would think that it is an unbelievable position to be in. I would not pick the back three without Simon Zebo in it.
Wow. Why not?
That's as far as I would go, because I think he, at the moment, when we come to the big, big matches, and people will say, well, he can only be tested in those big matches, but he has magic in his hands and magic in his feet that can break up a game. And if we can manage to get that fit in harness in the team, which I think he is doing at the moment, I think he's too special to leave out.
Would you play him at full back?
Well, I would play him on the wing if Rob Kearney isn't fit. And then if Rob Kearney is... I'd play him on the wing if Rob Kearney is fit.
Mm.
I think it is Rob Kearney, Simon Zebo, plus one.
And who's your one?
It is a selection decision that every coach would love to have. Dave Kearney, you go through them and try and pick him. And we're only actually just guessing, because Keith Earls is playing well, as well as he played for years. Dave Kearney adds that physicality and maybe the balance that you need. But then Rob Kearney brings that physicality. Tommy Bowe looked more like Tommy Bowe the last day. And we're not talking about Luke Fitzgerald even in that. But Luke played centre in the first game. So as a coach, it's the best. If everyone is fit, I would go Zebo, Kearney, Bowe.
Wow.
That is what I would go at the moment, because it has the size you need in the game. It's got the feet you need in the game. And that's the way the modern game has gone. Big people make a difference. But these are big people who are also very airily. They're very good. And they know how to score tries. Is that unbelievably harsh on Dave Kearney, who's actually probably been the player who's over the last couple of months really stepped up? Yes. Keith Earls looks back to his best. I think it's just an unbelievable position to be in. I was actually on pick side, and I was talking to Rob Kearney yesterday, and I said to him, I would hate to be Joe Schmidt, because the six into three just doesn't go. And whichever way he goes, I don't think it's any indicator for Joe Schmidt of what he'll go for the next game, because the pressure on them in training, watching them train, is immense. And that can only be good for the team. But I'll go back to my very first point. I want to see Ireland tested. I do not want us to win comfortably this weekend. I know everyone wants to, but we need to get ourselves into a proper match where it's, I won't say coming down to the wire, we don't want it to be a 2 or 3 point win, far from it, but I want them to be really struggling for long periods of the game, and I think we'll learn more from it then, and we'll learn more about the back three, and you know, hopefully Rob is fit, we'll see.
Brilliant as always, Connor. Thanks so much for your time.
Cheers, you.
Conor O'Shea there.
A couple of questions.
Sorry about that. Couple of texts in on 51552. I'm very surprised that all these drug users can race in the first place. So someone, I took drugs once and I couldn't make it out of my bedroom. Obviously taking the wrong drugs there, Dexter. Jerry in Dublin says, Hugh, you wouldn't cover cycling or athletics during the summer because you didn't believe in them, and then you give a huge amount of time to rugby. Surely you don't believe all these lads are clean. Just look at the size and shape of them. Couldn't be natural. Well, we did cover an awful lot of athletics during the summer. Rob Heffernan a few times, Olive Lochnan, Mark English, to name just a few. But the cycling, yeah, you got me there. We didn't really do a huge amount on the cycling for that reason. I do believe that rugby is clean until I hear or see evidence to the contrary. And maybe you say that's naive, and maybe there are a few guys who are taking stuff they shouldn't be taking, but we just haven't had any positive test results. For the most part, obviously a couple in South Africa, one or two here or there. But for the most part, I think it is clean. But again, maybe I'm just completely naive. What do you think, David?
No, I think majority, I'd agree with you. I think the majority of the lads would be clean in rugby. Obviously, I think if you were to probe a little bit deeper, I'd say, yes, there is probably a few there that might be. I'm not saying in Ireland, but in general, globally.
Yeah.
And we've seen that. But I think, you know, what is one issue is kind of size and kind of that... you know, that pressure from your peers to make teams and stuff like that, that maybe some guys could go down that route. But I think, to be honest with you, I'd believe it's clean.
Yeah, and it's a fair point, Jerry, I have to say, because you're not the only person that would have doubts. But until we know anything else, and I would be involved a lot in rugby, but, you know, at the moment, I have to say, yeah, I do believe it's clean. Let's just go over to Old Trafford then, and Darren Stanage is standing by because they're underway in the Champions League tonight, Manchester United against Wolfsburg. Darren.
Yeah, they are indeed. We've obviously only played about 3 or 4 minutes. United have been on the attack for most of that time. A cross is about to come in now, and it's headed away there. United with the strongest lineup, I think, that Louis van Gaal was able to play. Obviously, a few people missing through injury. Shaw, obviously. Carrick, Rojo, not involved today either. But no real goal opportunities for either side. It's United nil, Wolfsburg nil.
Thanks to me and Darren. We'll check in before full time. Okay, before full time here, that is. Just underway at Old Trafford. Quick break, and we're back with Shane Keegan and Wexford Youths after these.
Game on.
Game on.
2FM.
Goal, goal, goal at Old Trafford, Darren.
Yeah, and it's gone the way of the visiting team. Wow. Manchester United nil, Wolfsburg 1. It's Daniel Caligiuri who scored. Antonio Valencia played everybody onside. He was totally asleep at right back. A very simple finish and a shock scoreline, really. United nil, Wolfsburg 1.
What a start. OK, thanks to me and Darren. Shane Keegan, how are you?
Not a bother, Hugh, yourself?
Not a bother, pal. Good to talk to you again. Congratulations, first of all. Wexford Youths, Airtricity League Premier Division next season. That has a pretty nice ring to it.
It does have a nice ring to it, doesn't it? Yeah. That's if this Conroy report or Dermot Keely doesn't get us back down to the first before we're even started.
come on now, we'll have to know. Listen, we'll give it a bit of time. Look, what does it mean to you, Shane, and what does it mean to the club? Because I imagine it's massive.
Sure, it's been absolutely brilliant, Hugh. Yeah, I mean, it was my fourth season in charge this year, and an awful lot of that squad has been with me since the very, very beginning, and it's built steadily over the 4 years, but on the field and off the field. And we knew heading into the start of this year, as you say, I was on with you earlier in the year, and I said that we realistically thought we might have a crack at it this year, and it transpired that way, and everybody's smiling from ear to ear down there at the moment.
What was the key for you this season?
I think the fact that we had been building, I don't think it could possibly have transformed in one season, but we were getting closer and closer, and obviously we had a real good year last year, but I think it was actually, again, I was saying to you earlier in the year that the one thing we lacked last year was belief from the beginning. We kind of only realised towards the end, geez, we're not too bad, we're in with a shout here, whereas this time from the very outset we thought, right, we're going to give this a right good crack. And from day one, while nobody was really shouting and roaring about it, we did have an internal belief that we could give it a right go, and I think that made a big difference.
Because it's a young squad, Shane, if you don't mind me saying, and you know, obviously there's guys that have been with you for a long, long time, but just tell me what you know in terms of Mick Wallace's reaction and the people down there. Obviously he's put a huge amount into the club as well. You've given a lot of time, and you spoke about how difficult it is to get out of that first division. What does it mean for everybody involved?
Sure, it does. I mean, there's people involved in the club an awful lot longer than I am. It feels, you know, I'm only there 4 years, and yet it feels like an eternity. So I can imagine how long it feels for the likes of of Mick Wallace and the likes of a guy called Sean O'Shea, who'd be working away consistently in the background there and all kinds of things. And look, there was a couple of pictures doing the rounds there on the likes of Sports File and Facebook and that of Mick, and I think he couldn't but deny that there was a clear sign of tears in the eyes and a few tears been shed on his behalf, so there was. So it meant massive to him, and likewise to Sean O'Shea. And there's, again, you know, there's supporters that are there, you know, since day one, since it came into being, and a couple of those we've managed to kind of wrangle onto the committee as well in the last couple of years, and they've been a big driving force off the pitch as well. So look, you know, it's more than just management and players that take as much joy out of an occasion like that. Everybody loved it.
Alan, it's brilliant, isn't it?
It's absolutely brilliant to you, yeah. Fair play to them. Congratulations, Shane.
Alan, thanks a million.
Yeah, it is. I've been a big advocate, Hugh, of the whole kind of regional. There's so many teams in Dublin that you need as many regional teams as possible to get a good spread around the country. So to have Wexford Utes back in the Premier Division, or there for the first time, I think it's absolutely brilliant for them. So, and hopefully they'll do themselves justice. I've no doubt there's a lot to be said as well for a bit of continuity in terms of Shane. He's there 4 years. We see an awful lot of managers that only last maybe 6 months, a year, 18 months. So there's a lot to be said for actually sticking it out for the long haul in terms of development players and young players, and I think that's probably key in the fact that they got up this year, Hugh.
Yeah, so I mean, in terms of next season then, Shane, obviously the guys down there that you have on the books at the moment, I mean, I remember you saying to me they're barely getting their expenses there, there's no money to pay the players. What does it mean for next year and competing in the top flight and staying in the top flight, because I presume that's the next goal?
Ah, it is, absolutely, Hugh, and it is. Look, it's going to be a challenge. I mean, Mitch has spoken on a few different media streams that it is certainly going to be a challenge, so it is. But I suppose from maybe the halfway point in this season, it looked like, you know, that this was a real possibility and this was something that could happen. And I think really since then, I mean, since about June, July, I think the committee have, at that stage, start building a process and start building something that they believe could put us in a position where we could, you know, become somewhat competitive at that level. It's not something that's going to be, you know, a flick of a switch done overnight. There's been, you know, a few months of hard work put in already, and there's some serious months of hard work to come to put us in a position where we can be competitive. But at the moment, I think it's doable. We would probably be realistic enough to say that, you know, even with huge improvements, we'd probably still go into the season as probably having the smallest budget in the division. But look, I'd say we didn't have in the top four budgets this year, and look what we've done. So we're well capable of overachieving. We know that.
Well, listen, we're going to get you again because we'll do our end of the season review in a few weeks' time, I should say. But for the moment, Shane, congratulations and enjoy the final game in the season.
Alan Hugh, thanks a million.
Well, sound Shane Keegan there. Wexford Utes promoted to the Electricity League Premier Division. Ed Leahy, I should say, is a brilliant column on the Conroy report that was released last week in terms of what it means or doesn't mean for the future of domestic football in this competition. rtsport.ie/sport, and go on and have a look at it. Okay, David Gillick's book is called David Gillick's Kitchen. It's out in all good bookshops. Thanks so many for coming. Very much appreciate it.
No, thanks for having me.
I have to say, best luck to Scaries this weekend. I know you won't like that. Well, thanks, Dan. Thanks to Andrew and to Mary and everyone involved in the show today. We'll talk to you tomorrow. Louise is on the way.
Game on.
Game on.
2FM.